you'll see other people follow that. So that organizational attack, that networked attack, inspires people to carry out attacks on their own in a more independent way.
So if these attacks keep happening, even if ISIS is losing territory, did Donald Trump have a point in saying that President Obama has not been a success and has been largely a failure in confronting ISIS?
I don't think the Obama administration can claim a success in fighting ISIS or in fighting terrorism more broadly. If you ask me, do I have the genius idea that would have done it better than what they have done so far, I don't have it. What I fear is that the incoming administration is going to pour gasoline onto this fire. And it's also not just jihadist terrorism that's an issue here. What we've seen is that in the United States, domestic extremists have been greatly energized by the presidential campaign and a lot of the rhetoric that's coming out of here. And you know, when we look at how the media environment works, if you have domestic extremists who are like anti-Muslim extremists who lash out, you're going to see reverberation on that.
You know, a lot of Donald Trump's critics complained that he was painting an incredibly dark view of the world today. I mean, I'm just listening to you talk about that we might have to accept ISIS continuing to carry out attacks even if they're losing territory. Domestic terrorism might increase after this presidential campaign. You're saying that the Obama administration was not a success in fighting ISIS and that there might not be a way to end these attacks anytime soon. I mean, you seem to be painting a pretty dark world.
Yes and no. I mean, my view of the world and prospects for the year ahead is much darker than it was a few months ago. I think that, you know, an important element of this is how do we handle these attacks? You know, and this calls comfort to a lot of people, but in the scale of things that are likely to kill you, terrorism is still very low.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what I think that the Obama administration has done successfully is sort of keep these attacks in perspective. And what I worry about is that new administration may not do so. And the president of the United States has great power to set the terms under which we talk about these things. And if we set those terms in dystopian, alarming frames, then we're going to have to live in a dystopian, alarming world.
Do you see an end in the fight against terrorism anytime soon?
If you're asking me whether I think people will be good, work out all their problems anytime soon, no. I think that terrorism is, you know, a fact of life in the society in which we live. I think that if you look at the example of a group like the Ku Klux Klan, it's far from its peak, but it's still out there. It still has recruits. It's still connected to attempts to violence. It's enjoying somewhat of a resurgence today. These ideas don't go away completely, but you know, the question is whether we're going to let them dominate our public discourse.
Okay. J.M. Berger is a fellow with the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and also co-author of the book ISIS, The State of Terror. We really appreciate the time.
Thank you.
President Obama came into the White House 8 years ago, hailed for his skills as a communicator. But as he leaves office, by his own admission, Obama hasn't always been so skilled at making the case for his initiatives or for his achievements. NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith has this look at how the first major achievement of Obama's presidency played out.
Even before President Obama moved into the White House, he and his team made a choice that made actually selling his policies to the public more difficult. In December 2008, Obama's economic team gathered in Chicago to map out what would become the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act.
A dispute, discussion, something breaks out at that meeting. We haven't even come in yet.
Austin Goolsbee is a professor at the University of Chicago and was a top economic advisor in the early years of the Obama presidency. He says there were two schools of thought.
Doing something on the order of magnitude of the problem, which everyone understood is going to be a collection of a whole bunch of things and you're going to have a hard time explaining it.
Or
couldn't we just pick one thing and just do that one thing? And that would be really easy to explain.
The economy was hemorrhaging jobs, and Obama's economic team was afraid the country was on the brink of another Great Depression. The president chose to go big.
Today does mark the beginning of the end, the beginning of what we need to do to create jobs for Americans scrambling in the wake of layoffs.
Obama signed the Recovery Act in February of 2009. And even in that speech, the challenges of explaining the behemoth $780 billion package were clear. He talked about the millions of jobs it would save or create, a metric so squishy it proved hard for Obama to claim credit for it later, and made it easy for opponents to criticize the stimulus as a failure. He spent most of the speech talking about investments.
Rebuilding our crumbling roads and bridges, repairing our faulty dams and levees, bringing critical broadband connections to businesses and homes in nearly every community in America, upgrading mass transit.
But Frank Luntz, a Republican messaging expert, says to a lot of Americans, the word investment just sounded like code for big government spending.
There was real hostility early on, a feeling that it's just an expansion of Washington and nobody was going to benefit and everyone was going to get stuck with the tab.
Luntz says Obama's team overestimated Americans' appetite for stimulus spending. Republicans in Congress, who never supported the Recovery Act, repeatedly called it a failed trillion-dollar stimulus. In reality, a big chunk of it went to tax cuts. But in Obama's bill signing speech, the mention of those tax cuts came near the end.
About a third of this package comes in the forms of tax cuts, by the way, the most progressive in our history. Not only spurring job creation, but putting money in the pockets of 95% of hardworking families in America.
The way the tax cuts were distributed also limited any public relations benefit. The money just appeared in people's paychecks as a smaller payroll tax deduction.
Nobody realized, nobody understood, and so nobody celebrated it.
Again, Republican consultant Frank Luntz.
There's a simple rule in politics. If you don't talk about it, no one knows you did it, and you get no credit for it. And that was the problem with the tax cut component of Obama's stimulus package.
Goolsbee says the carefully designed tax cuts targeted at working Americans got little traction with the public.
At one point in the first year, there's a poll that comes out in which something like 60% of the country said that they were sick of the tax increases that had come from the stimulus, when in fact, 95% had gone down.
Goolsbee says this is when he began to realize that reality was relative, something that has truly taken hold in American politics now.
And at that point, you know, the president was basically asking the economic team, what is wrong with you people? And I just felt like punching myself.
Economists widely view the stimulus as having helped. But politically, Obama got none of the credit for the tax cuts and a whole lot of grief for the spending. This was a pattern that would repeat itself throughout his presidency. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:18, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us on this cold morning, and stay with us. We'll be bringing you headlines next from NPR and WPR. Hear what Governor Scott Walker's office has to say about the Department of Transportation secretary who stepped down yesterday. That story in a couple of minutes.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
Along with elaborate and exciting Lego constructions, WPR is proud to promote family-friendly events. For more information, go to wpr.org/events.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Officials in Moscow are disputing a report in the New York Times saying the head of Russia's anti-doping agency admits the existence of a mass doping program for Russian athletes. Charles Maines has more from Moscow.
The New York Times story quotes the Russian anti-doping chief as saying there was an institutional conspiracy involving Russian doping, although one that didn't involve top government officials. Well, now she's saying those words were taken out of context, and Russia's Minister of Sport insists there was no state doping program in any way. That charge, of course, is what led to a partial ban on Russian athletes from international competition, so it's a sensitive topic here.
The second of two flight recorders has been recovered from the crash of a Russian military plane in the Black Sea. The Christmas Day crash killed all 92 people aboard. Police in Philadelphia say they made four arrests at a shopping mall after a large group of teenagers caused a disturbance yesterday. Chief Inspector Scott Small is with the city police department.
They went to the food court area, and that's when they started running around, yelling and screaming, and acting disorderly.
Police say one person tried to attack an officer who was dispersing the crowd at the Philadelphia Mills Mall. Near Appleton, Wisconsin, a shopping mall was evacuated because of an unspecified threat. Authorities are investigating whether people on social media had been trying to coordinate disturbances at malls. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Maureen McCollum. Governor Scott Walker's office says Mark Gottlieb made his own decision to leave, even though he's gone against the Republican governor on highway funding issues in the past. The Republican Walker said yesterday that Secretary of Transportation Gottlieb will retire January 6th to be replaced by Safety and Professional Services Secretary Dave Ross, who's a former mayor of Superior. 2 years ago, Gottlieb's DOT proposed $750 million in tax and fee hikes that Walker rejected. This time, Gottlieb told lawmakers that the number of Wisconsin roads in poor shape would double in the next decade if new revenues are not found. He said he understood the governor's insistence not to raise taxes on state motorists. GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who also says a highway tax hike might be needed, praised Gottlieb, a civil engineer and former legislator, as being one of the state's most hardworking and articulate public leaders. Repeat drunken drivers will face tougher penalties in Wisconsin starting with the new year. Governor Scott Walker signed a law in April that makes a fourth drunken driving offense a felony, regardless of when it's committed. Currently, a fourth offense is a felony only if committed within 5 years of a third offense. The law also increases the maximum sentence for subsequent offenses. The measure goes into effect on January 1st. Wisconsin remains the only state that does not criminalize a first offense. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Ballard Spahr, a national law firm providing services in litigation, compliance, and transactions to clients across industries. Assessing the impact of national events and legal developments to keep clients informed. Learn more at BallardSpahr.com. From Focus Features, presenting A Monster Calls, a film about a boy dealing with the complications of life. He finds a most unlikely ally with the monster, voiced by Liam Neeson, who guides him on a journey of courage, faith, and trust, now playing in select theaters. And from the estate of Branna and Irving Sissonwine, supporting the collaborative newsgathering model of NPR and member station newsrooms, which seek to create a network that reflects and illuminates the fabric of America.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. Chicago passed a grim milestone recently. The city has seen more than 700 homicides this year. That's more than any other major U.S. city. Of course, that startling number does not begin to tell the whole story. As we're about to hear, each death reverberates in the lives of family and friends for decades. We begin with member station WBEZ's Miles Bryan.
14-year-old DeMarco Webster was helping his dad move to a new apartment a few months ago when he was shot and killed. His stepdad, Jawan Hester, says they had intentionally waited to start the move until after midnight in order to avoid any trouble. Hester says DeMarco didn't even like going outside if he didn't have to.
I don't understand, man. You know, what's going on now is like the future children, the good children, the smart children with scholarships, and they're the ones who's dying to gun violence.
Hester says just one day after his stepson was killed, his neighbor's twin teenage boys were both fatally shot too. Two more deaths in what's been a very bloody year in Chicago. The city surpassed last year's total of about 470 killings in September. Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel recently announced the city would hire about 1,000 new people to work in the police department.
These officers will be assigned directly to the streets of our communities to work with residents in partnership to confront gun violence.
But many here are skeptical that having more cops will stop the murders. Reverend Marshall Hatch has a church on the city's west side in one of the most violent neighborhoods. He says relations between police and the community have deteriorated since late last year when video is released of a Chicago officer fatally shooting Laquan McDonald, a young black man.
They've seen it in their best interest to pull back and not be, you know, aggressive. that probably has helped fuel a lot of the surge in violence that we've seen this year.
Chicago Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson says police are in a bind.
They're cautious because of the national narrative that's out there right now, so they're careful about how they do police. But at the same time, the biggest reason for this spike is because our repeat guys just don't fear the judicial system.
Johnson says Illinois needs tougher sentencing laws for repeat gun offenders. And locking up gang leaders did help in the late 90s, the last time the city saw this level of killing. But University of Illinois criminologist John Hagedorn says statistics can be misleading.
Today, the gangs are no longer structured and citywide. They're small cliques of kids. The reasons for the homicides are often insults, accidental events, very difficult kinds of things to contain.
Hagedorn says in the late 90s, Chicago police cleared about two-thirds of all the city's homicides, but now only clear about a quarter of them.
So we're dealing with a different kind of situation, which calls for some different policing strategies, but mainly it should tell the city that it has to address the roots of desperation.
Saonia Owens knows that desperation. Owens is from Chicago's South Side, where her 15-year-old son was shot and killed nearly 20 years ago.
When you shoot that boy, you're shooting that whole family. When you take that one bullet, you have destroyed a whole family. You might as well say you shot everybody.
Okay, a voice there capturing this difficult moment in Chicago, hitting 700 homicides this year. That story came from member station WBEZ's Miles Bryan.
WBEZ has been revisiting families affected by homicides in 1998. That was the last time the city suffered more than 700 murders. Reporter Patrick Smith talked with Kaisha Weekly about her childhood friend Candace Curry. Candace was playing in a park that summer when a stray bullet from a drive-by shooting took her life.
I met her when she was 9, and we was friends. We instantly connected, and, you know, every day we used to hang together, go to school together. Her mother, we used to go to her mama house and, you know, jump rope in front of her house. And that's Chrisette. This is my little baby, 3 years old. And our favorite spot to go to was the route. It was called Route 66. It was a skating place. It was skating on one side, and it was dancing on the other side. So our parents used to think that we used to go for the skate and we used to go for the dance part. Until one day, my grandma came and picked us up. Candace lost her life at 13. She came over, it was a summer day. She came over in the morning, we walked to the store, got our chips, juice, honey buns, and orange juice. Came back and sat on my back for a little while as we was talking and stuff. We were just sitting there talking. And she said that she was ready to go to the park. And I told her to wait for me so I could change my clothes. And she said she was gonna wait, but then she got impatient and said she'll be back or meet her up there. I told her, okay. And it was like soon as she got to the park, somebody was driving back. They say they was doing the drive back, trying to shoot at somebody else and shot her. Some guys came, ran to my house and told me, Candace got shot right as I was getting dressed for to go to the park. And I was tore. I didn't believe it, you know, but I didn't think that she would pass because she only got shot under her arm. So, yeah, I was heartbroken. I try not to think about it. Okay, Chrisette. Yeah, I try not to think about it. Sometimes I drink a lot to not think about the stuff that didn't happen in my life. It used to be a lot of shooting going on when I was growing up, and used to have to just sit on the floor, try not to get shot, can't look out the window. It's way worse than that, because they be hitting innocent people. Okay, baby. Love my baby. That's why, you know, can't sit on a bus stop with your kids, people getting shot, women getting, they shooting women, everything. They just, it's out of control.
That was Kaisha Weekly talking about her 13-year-old friend Candace Curry, who was killed in 1998.
Now, a few years after Candace's death, another teenage friend of Weekly's was killed, and then her brother, and then last year, her young nephew. This is NPR News.
In the 19th century, America was a golden land for immigrants in search of opportunity. Adele Field went the other way. She left New England for China.
The job of being a single American woman missionary was a great job for a woman who in the United States could get education but couldn't get a good job.
Missionaries and America's complicated history with China, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune into All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. It is 8:30 and this is Morning Edition on WPR. I'm Maureen McCollum. Still to come this hour, it's Wisconsin Life. In Wisconsin news, a federal workplace safety agency has cited a Wisconsin company after a teenage worker was fatally injured at a machine shop. The U.S. Occupational Health and Safety Administration said yesterday it has issued multiple safety and health violations against G.D. Roberts & Company of Columbus. Authorities say 17-year-old Dusty Babcock became trapped in a machine at G.D. Roberts in June. Police say Babcock was cleaning scrap metal under a laser cutter when the machine engaged and came down on him. He later died. OSHA found that the company failed to ensure procedures were followed to lock out the machine and did not train its employees properly in such safety procedures. The agency is proposing $119,000 in penalties. G.D. Roberts says it continuously improves its workplace safety and is cooperating with OSHA. The only Wisconsin congressman to leave Washington next week has mixed reviews on his party's incoming president. Northeast Wisconsin Republican Reed Ribble of Sherwood says it's interesting that Donald Trump's cabinet picks have mostly been mainstream conservatives. But Ribble remains an opponent of Trump, as he's been for months. He tells WHBY Radio in Appleton that Trump attracted voters who thought they were victims of the people and nations that Trump labeled as villains on the campaign trail, China among them. Ribble said that his fellow Republicans cannot just drop most pieces of Obamacare right away, as both Trump and House Speaker Paul Ryan of Janesville have pledged to do. Ribble says that would create uncertainty and rising prices in the healthcare market. This is WPR.
Support for WPR's marketing and promotions comes from the Harold A. Engel Memorial Communications Arts Internship Fund, helping WPR employ a graduate fellow from the Wisconsin School of Business Bolt's MBA in the Arts program.
Support for WGTD comes from Andrea's, proudly serving our Kenosha community since 1911. Visit Jack's Cafe for homemade soups, salads, and sandwiches. For today's specials, go to andreasgifts.com.
It'll be mostly cloudy in Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the lower to mid-30s, except in the mid to upper 30s, closer to Lake Michigan.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Care.com, offering HomePay, a solution for nanny payroll, tax, and HR obligations, from automatic payments to preparing state and federal tax returns. Learn more at care.com/HomePay. From Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization providing educational travel adventures, including experiences for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at gatesfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm David Green.
And I'm Rachel Martin. And I'm joined this Wednesday morning by commentator and columnist Cokie Roberts. It's part of our new regular segment where we ask you, the listeners, to send questions about the ways of Washington and politics over to Cokie, and then she answers them. Unsurprisingly, with the new administration coming to the White House, there is more than a little curiosity about the various roles of members of the Trump family. So Cokie is here to answer one question in particular about Ivanka Trump. Good morning, Cokie.
Hi, Rachel. This is fun.
This is very fun. I had the same question. So let's listen to one of our listeners explain. Here is the question.
My name is Karen Olstad, and I live in Bellingham, Washington. I heard that Ivanka Trump will get an office in the White House in the same space reserved for the First Lady. Ivanka's title is still to be determined. What's wrong with First Lady if she is doing the job? Is there a regulation that the First Lady has to be the wife of the president? Thanks.
So, Cokie?
Actually, we think that the title First Lady was designed for someone who was not the wife of the president. The first time that title was ever in the newspapers was during the Buchanan administration when his niece, Harriet Lane, was serving as First Lady. He was our only bachelor president. It was a terrible time, of course, in America, right before the Civil War. She got high marks for trying to keep Northerners and Southerners from killing each other in the White House. But the title First Lady probably did start with her. It would also be true that Ivanka Trump has been saying that she doesn't expect to have an office in the White House, but she is likely to play a role because she's clearly one of her father's major advisors, and she probably will play that hostess role, at least until Melania arrives in Washington later in the year.
A hostess role is one thing, but weighing in on policy is something different. And Ivanka Trump has talked about being interested in real substantive issues, child care in particular, issues related to working moms. Have we seen other first daughters be in this position before?
Well, we've seen first daughters really be powerful back to the James Monroe administration when his wife, Elizabeth Monroe, was not well and his daughter, Eliza Hay, took over the first lady role. And she was very powerful in Washington and nobody could stand her. She was mean. In fact, I'm quoting now from her successor, Louisa Catherine Adams, the wife of John Quincy Adams, who said, "She is so proud and so mean, no reputation is safe in her hands."
Whoa.
"And I had never, since the first moment of my acquaintance with her, have heard her speak well of any human being." And Margaret Truman also filled in a lot. And then you had other first daughters like Maureen Reagan, who was co-chair of the Republican National Committee, but definitely not first lady.
We've seen first ladies in the past take on kind of an issue that's their signature cause. Mrs. Trump, Melania Trump has said she wants to address cyberbullying. How did this originate?
Actually, Martha Washington, right there, right at the start, lobbied Congress for veterans benefits because she had been at camp with the Revolutionary War soldiers every winter of the long Revolutionary War. And many first ladies since then have taken on these roles of finding a cause but also exerting power. And it's been interesting to see Mrs. Obama say how she's willing to help Mrs. Trump along these lines in the same way that Mrs. Bush helped her.
Well, you have actually sat down on a couple of occasions with Mrs. Obama and Mrs. Bush, who genuinely seem to have some kind of rapport. How important is it in presidential transitions that first ladies communicate well?
It makes it much, much easier for the incoming administration. And Michelle Obama says that Laura Bush has been there with her from the beginning. And interviewing the two women together is a delight because they really genuinely are friends, but they're also very interested in bettering the positions of women and girls around the world, something they plan to do together. It would set a good example for the men, Rachel.
Indeed. Commentator and columnist Cokie Roberts, she will join us Wednesdays to answer your questions. You can tweet us at Morning Edition with the hashtag AskCokie. Of course, you can join the conversation on Snapchat, snap us at NPR, or you can email us the old-fashioned way, askcokie@npr.org. Cokie, thanks so much.
Happy New Year, Rachel.
Happy New Year, Cokie.
All right, one of the most anticipated television shows of 2017 is Showtime's revival of Twin Peaks. NPR TV critic Eric Dagan says the new show's biggest challenge may be surpassing its own groundbreaking history.
There is so little information available about the plot of Showtime's Twin Peaks revival that one promo just features co-creator David Lynch eating a donut. He's dressed like a character he played from the show, FBI Bureau Chief Gordon Cole, while the series' mournful theme music plays in the background. Fans would expect no less from Lynch, an eccentric, Oscar-nominated director known for staying tight-lipped about his projects. He created Twin Peaks for ABC back in 1990 with Mark Frost, a writer for NBC's pioneering cop drama, Hill Street Blues. The story began with the murder of homecoming queen Laura Palmer in the fictional town of Twin Peaks, Washington. The FBI agent sent to investigate the case was Kyle MacLachlan's Dale Cooper, a guy who liked to read detailed notes on just about everything into a tape recorder for an assistant named Diane.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th. Entering the town of Twin Peaks, 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 12 miles west of the state line. Never seen so many trees in my life.
What followed was a series that redefined the boundaries of television. It mashed up genres, moving from a noirish murder mystery to a surreal, dreamlike supernatural story. And it sparked legions of fans obsessed with the show's weird details, like the Log Lady, a woman who seemed to communicate with supernatural forces through a log she carried around. And now they want to try doing it again. Showtime's revival features MacLachlan, along with much of the series' original cast. Clues about the revival's plot may be found in a new book by Frost called The Secret History of Twin Peaks. It features a dossier filled with documents connected to Cooper's investigation that another FBI agent must sort through to figure out who assembled them. In the original Twin Peaks, Lynch and Frost created an odd, surprising universe fans could immerse themselves in, a bold move for 1990s television. Later TV shows and films like Fargo and The X-Files took that approach to new levels. The question now is, how will Lynch and Frost keep surprising fans at a time when so much of today's quality TV already feels like a distant homage to Twin Peaks? I'm Eric Deggans.
This is NPR News.
It is 8:41, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for being with us this morning, and stay tuned. Headlines are coming up next from NPR and WPR. In 10 minutes, hear how music critic N. Powers explains why David Bowie's album Black Star has been one of the most enduring records of the year. That story and song clips in 10 minutes.
WPR has been a radio pioneer since 1917. That's nearly 100 years of great radio. We're proud of our legacy, and we're grateful for the listener support that makes it possible. Thanks to you, WPR's bright future includes more in-depth news, world-class music, great discussions, and entertainment. To continue the spirit of innovation, make your year-end gift now at WPR.org. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. A Tunisian man is being detained in Germany. The BBC's Damian McGinnis says the 40-year-old is being questioned about possible links to last week's truck attack in Berlin that killed a dozen people.
The man's telephone number was found in a mobile phone belonging to the attacker, Anis Amri, who later died in a shootout with Italian police in Milan. German officials are now investigating the suspect and have until tomorrow to decide whether to formally arrest him. 12 people were killed in the attack, and the tragedy has sparked a fierce debate in Germany about boosting surveillance, such as security cameras in public spaces.
Nearly 50 people were injured in the attack. Federal prosecutors in New York are charging 3 Chinese citizens with insider trading. NPR's Rob Schmitz says they're accused of making trades using data stolen from law firms by hackers.
The 3 suspects allegedly hacked into the computer systems of several prominent U.S. law firms, stealing data involving mergers and acquisitions. They're accused of then buying shares of the companies involved, making more than $4 million in the process. One of the 3 suspects was arrested in Hong Kong on Sunday, and the other 2 are at large.
Authorities in the Florida Keys say 3 teenagers from California have been rescued after their boat capsized. They managed to dial 911. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Maureen McCollum. The Wisconsin Supreme Court says the State Department of Justice does not have to release videos featuring Republican Attorney General Brad Schimmel speaking at training seminars. The state Democratic Party sued in 2014 to obtain videos of presentations on sexual predators that Schimmel gave. The Supreme Court agreed today, ruling 5-2, that the public harm outweighs disclosure. Wisconsin's Oneida Tribe of Indians is suing the city of Green Bay over a failed energy project. The tribe had the go-ahead from the city to build an energy plant, but that permission was later rescinded. Patty Murray reports.
The $21 million suit was filed in federal court on Friday. The Oneida Tribe Seven Generations Corporation asserts it's lost $5 million in startup costs and another $16 million in lost future profits. The plant was planned for Green Bay and would have burned municipal solid waste to turn into gas. After having first approved the development in 2011, the city council reneged on the deal the next year. Wisconsin's Supreme Court has ruled that the city council's action was improper. No one from the Oneida Tribe was available for comment. A spokesperson for Green Bay's mayor says the city has yet to be served with a complaint and has no formal comment. Patty Murray, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It'll be a cloudy day in Wisconsin today. Temperatures will be in the 30s. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Atlassian, maker of collaboration software Jira, Confluence, HipChat, and Bitbucket. Atlassian works to help teams across industries ascend to new heights to create what's next. At Atlassian.com. Atlassian. Team up. From Diane and Hal Brierley, in support of NPR's work to engage its audience in the discussion of today's issues and provide in-depth journalism and thought-provoking stories. And from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation at gatesfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio, and now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik on a life-altering decision.
Recognizing who you are and deciding to take steps to live that life takes a lot of reflection and time. There's no one way. Natalie Miller tells us how she found herself and made a life-changing decision to transition.
I knew something was going on by the age of 11 or 12. Didn't know what. All I knew is that the feelings I was having, the things I wanted to gravitate towards, society told me it was not okay. And my family told me it was not okay. It's just everyone in your life tells you it's not okay living your life as a boy to do those things and to want those things and to associate with those things. So I didn't. So I just kept moving forward and living a life that made everyone else very, very happy, except for myself. The only instances that I had seen was exposure through things like Jerry Springer, where these individuals were held up as freaks in many cases. That was my earliest examples of something that I might be feeling, and that's terrifying. So I would go through these cycles of, you know, go back into the closet, go back into hiding, pretend it was all just a phase. I could still be this man that the world wanted me to be, but that I wasn't. I hit this point in my life. I remember the night very vividly. It was a February evening in 2011. And, you know, middle of the night, and I couldn't sleep, and I was just in tears. And I remember picturing in my mind being in this dark stone-floored dungeon. There's doors on all of the walls all around me. And these doors had been the paths I had been taking all these years prior. And they led away from the dungeon. They led away from this dark place for a while, but inevitably they all led back. And there was only two doors left that I had not tried at that point. And one of them was the door to nothing, the door to ending it all. And the other door that I had never tried was the one of accepting it and moving forward with it. I had finally reached a point where I was strong enough to say I would rather live a short life as myself, as my true, authentic self, than a long life, living a life that outwardly looked successful to everyone else, but I was miserable. And so I took that step. Oh, I expected everyone to leave me. I expected the world to just turn its back on me and I would be left alone. And very often in the transgender community, that is the case. My experiences have been very much the opposite. I came out to my parents, and though they didn't understand, they still loved me and they still accepted me and they still were there for me. I came out to my siblings, and though they don't understand, and maybe they never will, they are still there for me. They have not turned away from me. I came out to my friends, and I came out in waves. I came out, like, I would pick a group of people and I would share the message with them, and I would cringe. I would be waiting for that other shoe to drop. And then I would start breathing and realize that it's not going to. Like, hey, they're all still here. Transitioning in rural southeastern Wisconsin, small town, I've been met with acceptance. I've been met with understanding and caring and kindness. Like, I was not expecting the level of kindness that I met.
Natalie Miller is an advocate and financial representative based in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
It's 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and this is Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Make sure to stay with us. Morning Edition continues next, and classical music begins in a little over 10 minutes.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
On Arboretum Drive in Madison, WPR is pleased to support free, family-friendly activities. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
It'll be mostly cloudy across Wisconsin today. Highs will be in the lower to mid-30s, except in the mid to upper 30s, closer to Lake Michigan. Tonight, there is a slight chance of light freezing rain and snow showers, with lows in the lower to mid-20s. Tomorrow, chance of snow showers through the day.
Support for WPR comes from the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, committed to advancing science through innovative data collection and study design, providing web, phone, and in-person research methods. UWSC.wisc.edu.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. This is college football's big moment on the calendar. It's bowl season. And, of course, we now also have a college football playoff system that crowns a champion. Commentator John U. Bacon, though, has a theory about why the NCAA introduced a playoff, and it has nothing to do with actually picking a winner.
For years, the NCAA longed to build a football playoff system for one simple reason: money. Unlike basketball's March Madness, which generated a record $1 billion in advertising revenue alone in 2013, the NCAA did not make a dime off the bowl system that year. Who did? TV, the bowl organizers, and the coaches. That's who. Well, enough of that. When NCAA President Mark Emmert announced the new four-team football playoff would start in 2014, the TV rights alone would be worth almost half $1 billion. That's billion with a B, for just three games. So what if college football survived just fine without a playoff for 145 years, since Rutgers and Princeton played the first football game back in 1869? Year by year, they added game after game. First, they quadrupled the number of bowl games from 11 to 41, which require 82 teams to fill them. Now just about any team with the pulse gets to go. Then they tacked on a 12th regular season game, which schools used to play tomato cans like McNeese State, Norfolk State, and Bethune-Cookman, all just to grab another payday. Then they piled on conference title games, too, increasing the total games a team can play from 11 to 14, just too shy of an NFL season. But we need a playoff now, they told us, to determine who's the best on the field. How? Instead of picking two teams based on polls, strength of schedule, and computerized rankings, now they pick four teams based on polls, strength of schedule, and computerized rankings. Problem solved. So now instead of the third-ranked team complaining that it got screwed, the fifth-place team does all the whining. Another problem solved. Who wins? The coaches, whose compensation can actually double if they win the national title. How many coaches, faced with a star receiver who got caught plagiarizing or a quarterback with a concussion, would have the integrity to bench those players and forfeit a $5 million payday? I suspect very few. And then there's the TV ratings, the one thing everybody agreed would improve. Turns out they actually dropped dramatically in only the playoffs' second year. One reason? they stubbornly insist on scheduling the first round for New Year's Eve. Well, guess what? On New Year's Eve, even football fans have got better things to do. Sure, it's always easier to say the old way was better, but it's even easier when you've got the data to back it up.
That's commentator and author John U. Bacon.
This is the time of year when music critics go back through all the albums of 2016 and rank them. And there is what may be to some a surprising name at the top of a lot of those lists, the late, great David Bowie.
Something happened on the day he died. Spirit rose a meter and stepped aside.
The album is called Black Star, and it was the pop icon's last album before he died.
I'm a black star.
NPR's music critic Ann Powers says it set the tone for music throughout the entire year. Ann joins us now to talk more about it. Hi, Ann.
Hey, Rachel. How are you today?
I'm doing well. So, huge name, this huge, important album that you say you could feel in other works throughout 2016. How so?
I think it's safe to say that many of us had a surprisingly challenging year in 2016. Aside from Bowie, there were many other significant music losses, including Prince and Leonard Cohen, many others.
Yeah.
So to have this beautiful work that gently carries us into the next realm, but at the same time violently engages with the struggle to live and to die, this was an album that many of us returned to cope with 2016.
David Bowie was fighting cancer when he was making this album, and we should say he died just days after its release. Was he, in a way, writing his own eulogy with us?
I mean, there's no doubt that Bowie was aware of how very, very sick he was, but he also kept the dire nature of his illness from his collaborators and insisted that he would be able to continue on. So does it feel like a dying man's gasp? No, it doesn't. It feels so eloquent, yet it offers this view into that experience that is useful to all of us, even as it's so sad to listen to.
Look up here, I'm in heaven.
And the music itself is distinct, right? It's really different than the Bowie that a lot of us grew up listening to.
It's different than the Bowie of Life on Mars or Let's Dance, but it is consistent with the other major strain throughout Bowie's career, which was really art music and experimenting. For this work, Bowie was working with jazz musicians, notably Donnie McCaslin and his quartet. So it's different than what you hear on the radio, but it's very much a through line with his earlier stuff. And in fact, I think he was looking back on his own canon, and those memories are embedded in these songs.
There's obviously a huge emotional component to this work, but as a critic, how do you think it stacks up, this album, against his best work?
Oh, I think it will remain in the major canon of David Bowie's work. It's remarkable how well he orchestrated his whole career. Here's a man who began with a plan, who began with an idea to change rock and roll, to make it into a total art form that had room for elements taken from film and theater and all kinds of musical styles. And he did that every phase of his career. And with this final one, he realized it beautifully.
I knew something's very wrong.
NPR music critic Ann Powers. Thanks so much, Ann.
Thank you, Rachel.
With blackouts, hearts, with flowered news, with skull designs upon my shoes, I can't give.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green.
I can't give everything.
You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. Just before 9 o'clock, thanks for joining us for Morning Edition, and tune in each weekday between 5 and 9 o'clock. More news later today on BBC NewsHour at 3, followed by All Things Considered.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Wisconsin Alumni Association, devoted to keeping higher education accessible through the University of Wisconsin's annual campaign. More information is at supportuw.org.
Support for WGTD comes from the staff of Piasecki Althaus Funeral Home, who understand the holidays can seem hopeless, but there is hope, help, and support by texting HOPELINE to 741-741. Someone will listen or be a resource for you to give you help and hope. Text HOPELINE to 741-741.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha.